MacCast, Monday, March 12th, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's Monday morning, at least for me. Hope you are having a good start of your week, wherever you might be, and whenever you might be listening to this. We should have a pretty good episode for you today. We've got a few things to get into. We're going to talk about new iPad Pros and maybe Face ID coming to those models. What's next for the HomePod? Also, analysts, they're still kind of down on iPhone 10 sales. We'll talk about that a little bit more, and I'll give you my thoughts on that. Also, in California, they think you deserve the right to repair your iOS devices. We'll talk about that. And then possibly another new Apple TV show with some pretty well-known hosts, if Apple can swing it. We'll get into that, plus your feedback, a tip about ringtones, and I have a pretty cool thing of the moment for you to round out this episode. So it should be a good show. Let's just jump right in with some of the latest news. Face ID, iPad Pro possibly coming this June. This news is coming from a note to investors by Rosenblatt Securities analyst Jun Zhang. He claims that there will be an iPad Pro with a slimmer bezel, no home button, and Face ID. And looking at the timing, he says the iPad should be ready for mass production with a release date likely in the late second quarter of this year. That's leading a lot of people to speculate that there could be an announcement of a new iPad Pro at Worldwide Developer Conference, which is coming up at the beginning of June. And that, I would say, makes a lot of sense since Apple announced the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, the last update in the latest lineup of iPad Pros, at Worldwide Developer Conference last year. So I don't think that's too big of a stretch. The timing seems to all work out. What is up for debate in the media right now seems to be if the new models will have a notch or will they be notchless. Is Apple going to continue to design from the iPhone X into the iPad Pro, or will they somehow just tuck the TrueDepth camera system inside that slimmer bezel some way? I guess it would have to be a little bit thicker. I have kind of mixed feelings about this, and I'd be curious to know what you think. But my opinion is that they will likely go with the notch. And I know for a lot of people that's controversial. And also in an iPad Pro, I don't know if it works as well because of the width as it would with an iPhone 10, you know, the little ears, the horns, whatever you want to call them. You know, I'm getting used to them. I have to tell you, the notch for me on a day-to-day basis with my iPhone 10 really doesn't matter too much. I honestly don't notice it. The biggest thing I've struggled with actually is just the new gestures for specifically Access and Control Center. I often forget that on my iPhone 10, I have to go up to the little ear. And that may be because I still have, you know, an iPad Pro that I access Control Center in the other method, swiping up from the bottom. So it is a little bit of a learning curve. I know I'm getting older too. I worry about that a little bit sometimes, that maybe my memory isn't quite what it used to be. But that does bring up the point of, with a new iPad Pro, would it make more sense to have the notch and kind of the two gesture areas, or do they kind of keep iPads the way they are now? And I'm guessing they're going to go with a notch, not only for the UI reasons, but I think it brings consistency into the line. It kind of becomes this unique thing, although not so unique anymore because other Android devices are starting to get notches now as well. But it was kind of a neat, distinctive UI feature of the iPhone X. Or I guess not really UI, what I want to say is visual feature of the design of the iPhone X, and carrying that into the iPad Pro line and the iPad line would make a little bit of sense. But it'll be curious to see what Apple ultimately does. Certainly there is going to be the TrueDepth camera system in there. if they are going to bring Face ID to the iPad. The question will be, are they going to make any changes or improvements over the version that's in the iPhone 10, or is it going to be exactly the same thing? And at this point, we really don't know. But there is one China supply chain report so far that also claims the updated models could feature an 8-core A11 Bionic chip with 3 high-performance cores and 5 energy-efficient cores. So a nice little bump up to the processor. I would expect that with new iPads, so nothing earth-shattering there. The question is it going to be correct on the number of cores and sort of how they're laid out in there? It kind of makes sense, but I'm not much up on the processor stuff, so I don't know. And how much stock to put into that rumor, again, coming from the supply chain. And there is also a rumor more immediately that Apple, and this comes from sources last week, that Apple may also update that 9.7-inch iPad with a new lower price point. I think we talked about that in the last episode of the MacCast, and that could be coming up in March, although now we're hearing the price point could be $259 US, and it's really not clear if there's also going to be any kind of spec bump there, or if it's simply just a price drop to kind of invigorate iPad sales a little bit as they transition to the updates for the iPad Pros. So we'll have to wait and see if that happens. I think it makes sense for Apple to do a little update to the 9.7-inch iPad as well. And price drop certainly isn't going to hurt sales at all. And it's still a very popular model, so it would make sense for Apple to do that. Also coming from that same source at Rosenblatt, Jun Zhang, he says that along with the iPad Pro, Apple is also planning on possibly creating a smaller, less expensive version of the HomePod. He doesn't have a firm release date on this, but mentions the second half of this year, so toward the end of the year, about the same time frame Apple released the original iPod, or HomePod rather. I'm going to get those mixed up, the names always being so close together. He says it could sell for between $150 and $200. And since the HomePod also doubles as a HomeKit hub, I think this would be a great option for folks who maybe don't want an Apple TV. That price point, $150 to $200, I think is a really great price point if Apple can pull that off. The question becomes, you know, how does that fit in with the higher end, larger $349 HomePod? And is it going to be sort of an additive thing, or is it a replacement? Is it kind of like the same principle that Amazon takes on with the Echo and the much cheaper Echo Dot? So what are the feature differences? What are the speaker differences? I would imagine there's still going to be a very big focus on the audio quality, even if Apple goes with a smaller unit. And I'd be curious if you can kind of mix and match them together. You know, are the big ones going to work with the small ones in terms of setting up a soundscape inside a room, things like that? So there's a lot of questions about what might go on there, but certainly having a lower priced option for the HomePod, sort of expanding out the line, that is something that Apple typically does, right? They come out with a product like the iPhone or the iPod, have just one kind of version and model to start with, and then sort of expand out the line into different price points to kind of keep sales going and stuff like that. It's a model that Apple has used over and over again. So I would say overall, it kind of makes sense. Now, Barclays analyst Blayne Curtis said in a note to his investors that Apple's HomePod, the current version, sales have been, quote, underwhelming. He claims that Apple was originally planning a first production run of between 6 to 7 million units. And I have to say, when I was reading this report, it's always something that I take with a grain of salt when analysts are sort of trying to decide or talk to investors about what Apple's sales or what Apple wanted sales or expected sales to be. I'm always a little leery of, you know, what they're saying, because I don't think they honestly know what Apple's expectations for HomePod are. They're just guessing at that. And so to make statements that, you know, production or sales are underwhelming is a little bit of a stretch. And the estimate of 6 to 7 million units to me, just based on some of the other things that I know, seems way too high. For example, Amazon sold 7 million Echo units in the third quarter of 2017. And the total worldwide smart speaker market is around 40 million units, or was around 40 million units last year. So if Apple was expecting to sell 6 to 7 million HomePods, I'm assuming they mean in the first quarter of sales, that is a massive number. That would be right up there day one with Amazon Echo. And I just don't believe that Apple would have that high of an expectation, especially for a first generation product like the HomePod to kind of come in and make that splash. And in fact, another analyst claims that current HomePod sales are actually on track to meet Apple's target of about 5 million units. And if that is a number that they hit, I think even that's not too shabby. I mean, that's the number of Macs they sell in a given quarter, right around 4 or 5 million units. So if Apple can hit that with HomePod, I think they would be doing very, very well. So I just don't buy that the sales are necessarily underwhelming. I think we need to wait until Apple has their quarterly results call and see what kind of comments Apple makes about their feelings about how well HomePod is doing. Of course, one of the big sort of critiques from a lot of people about HomePod is the Siri functionality that some people feel it's just not doing enough, that it's not smart enough. And in fact, one of Siri's creators this week, Norman Winarski, he made some comments that Siri's capabilities have fallen a little bit short of where he would have expected them to be after Apple acquired the technology about 7 years ago. So Apple's been working with Siri for about 7 years, and he was expecting things to be a little bit further along. Now, In the piece, he talks about the fact that the original vision for Siri was to kind of perfect the technology in just two key categories. So they were looking at travel and entertainment, and they were going to like take it all the way as far as they could in those two categories before starting to expand into some other related areas. And so he points out that Apple kind of took a broader, more encompassing approach. They started bringing in more features and functionality. And again, that makes a lot of sense because they were integrating it with the current iOS ecosystem. But he ultimately concludes that he thinks Apple's trying to achieve a, quote, level of perfection that they can't get. And he points out that right now Siri kind of has an imperfect grasp of users' preferences and the past history of things that they do, and therefore that the predictive intelligence of Siri is a little bit limited. And I think that's what he's talking about when he thought it would be a little bit further along. Then it's kind of this concept of Siri being able to understand and sort of pre-predict what you might be asking at any given moment. And it's something that Apple's competitors have worked pretty hard on, Google Home, and I think Google gets a lot of praise for this. I haven't personally used the system too much. And, you know, Amazon has a lot of features and functionality, but I can tell you from personal experience with my Amazon Echo, a lot of it feels very much like Siri is, where you can ask certain questions, but that follow-up, it isn't always perfect, right? It doesn't always seem to know based on your past things that you've asked about or time or other information that it has. It doesn't always make the smartest decisions. And I think Siri is suffering, or does feel like it suffers a little bit from that. So I would agree there's some work to be done there. He does note at the end of the piece that all of these things are extremely hard problems to solve. And again, Apple, by expanding the scope of functionality, they made that task even harder. So I don't think he's really down on Siri necessarily. It's just, you know, from the direction they were moving in, Apple went a completely different way, and they have a lot of work. And so even after 7 years, they maybe haven't achieved everything that the original creators for Siri were thinking. But I have to tell you, you know, overall, I've been very happy, especially with the HomePod, with the functionality. It does most of the tasks that I need it to do on a daily basis. And that's things like, of course, playing music. It's absolutely fabulous at that. But just even general knowledge questions, asking about local restaurants and things like that, getting weather and news, handles all of those things very, very well. I think where it could be improved is the ability to kind of understand and have more of a conversation with Siri, right? Each request kind of has to exist on its own, and it doesn't really handle a lot of those follow-on questions very well. And I find myself having to rephrase when I want to ask about certain things. So if I'm asking for a sports score, I should be able to then just ask general questions about players' names and things like that. And that doesn't always work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So a little bit of improvements to go on there. But I think overall, you know, Apple's still doing a pretty good job, at least in my opinion. I know a lot of people debate with that. And if you want to share your opinions on that, shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And kind of rounding out some of the Apple audio news for this week, there are reports of possible updated AirPods in the works. AirPods continue to sell very well for Apple. It's believed that Apple is on track to sell as many as 30 million AirPod units in 2018. So that's a pretty big deal. That's a nice number. That may be boosted, though, by a potential second-generation version. Bloomberg says Apple could release later this year. New features include an integrated voice coprocessor for Siri, so you'll be able to say that "Hey Lady" command for your AirPods without actually having to tap them. So that kind of frees up some of the side controls. They also mention noise-canceling improvements, but say that that's going to be a passive system. So I think this is the idea of just maybe better sealing of the fit of the HomePod, or the AirPods rather, so that they block out a little bit more surrounding noise. They say it does not, it is not going to be an active noise cancellation system. The report also claims that there could be another revision coming later in 2019 that would add basic waterproofing. I find a little bit odd about that rumor is that it doesn't seem like waterproofing would be that big a feature to hold out for another update. Meaning, if they're going to do an update to the AirPods, why wouldn't they just bring in basic waterproofing in the next version? So that's a little bit odd. I don't know why you would hold off on that unless they're going for complete waterproof. Meaning that you could potentially have some designs that would work for maybe swimming workouts and things like that. So maybe that's the kind of thing that they're looking into. But they also mentioned that there could be a possible short-term price drop of the current models as Apple waits to put out the new versions. And again, I think that would help juice sales a bit of the current generation, although it doesn't seem like they need that at this point, because I think it's still a little bit tricky to get your hands on a set of HomePods. And again, as we mentioned at just a minute ago, Apple is selling them still very, very well. But that's kind of the latest on Apple's audio products at this point. Analysts continue to hound on the fact that iPhone X sales are not meeting their expectations, and that iPhone X sales are slowing down quicker than Apple would have anticipated. Again, the problem I have with this is Apple seems to be telling us the exact opposite story, at least if we want to believe what Tim Cook was talking about in the last quarterly results call. But among analysts, the feeling is that consumers are starting to already anticipate the next versions of the iPhone X, and specifically that new, larger, less expensive 6.1-inch LCD model that we've heard rumors about and we've been talking about on the last few episodes. And that should come out when they update the iPhone X and iPhone 8 models later this year. Now, speculation is that Apple might update the iPhone X line, because it's not doing so well, with a Product Red edition to kind of help juice up current sales a little bit. Again, I'm not convinced that's something they need to do, but certainly Apple will typically put out a Product Red version of their devices, and it will help add to the current sales that are going on. But again, I just don't think that iPhone X sales are that disappointing for Apple. I think they went in eyes wide open, knowing what consumers are looking for and knowing that they were going to release three different models and kind of sell across those models. And that seems to be what's going on. Again, looking at the last quarterly results, iPhone X, iPhone 8, and iPhone 8 Plus all seem to be selling about evenly. iPhone sales just down a little bit in last numbers, but profits were up. And I think that's, you know, that's about the best that Apple can expect with such a mature product lineup. And we also discussed last week the fact that there are a certain number of consumers that are looking for even larger phones and also maybe more cost-efficient or cost-effective phones for them. And Apple is going to be addressing those with the new models that we're hearing about this year. So I think iPhone sales are going just fine, at least from Apple's perspective. A couple other quick iPhone things. Apple has an interesting patent. And I know we don't talk about patents too much here on the MacCast. That's because a lot of times patents don't mean a lot. They don't necessarily end up in products. But I found this one particularly interesting because it has to do with lightning cable designs that would provide a watertight seal. So Apple looking to even tighten up water intrusion issues with the iPhone more by adding lightning cables. I don't know why you would necessarily need this. I've never had my iPhone drop into water. I guess it would be, you know, for like spills and things like that. If you have your iPhone on your nightstand and it's sitting there charging, water tips over, it's not going to get into the lightning connector if you have one of these new cables plugged in. One version of the lightning cable would actually deform or sort of expand on the end when it was inserted into the device. I'm not really sure exactly how that would happen. Seems like you could almost do that with just a little rubber seal around the tip of the lightning cable. But Apple has a couple of different patent designs for this. Some are on the lightning cable side and some are on the iPhone side. It makes more sense to me that you'd want to do something on the lightning cable side, because if there was an issue with the seal or the mechanism that was inside the iPhone, that seems like it would be a more costly repair. Whereas if it was a problem with the lightning cable, you'd be able to just swap out the lightning cable for a new version. But I don't know. What do you think about that? Do we need waterproofing around our lightning cable? Seems like with wireless charging kind of taking off, that at a certain point, the lightning cable may go away entirely. And then maybe you don't need a watertight lightning cable seal. And again, that's why sometimes we don't talk about patents here, because this may be something that never sees the light of day. But I still found it kind of interesting to see that Apple was working on this. And then I guess more on the software side as it relates to iPhone and iOS, there is a story out this week that Swift is now a top 10 programming language, and it's actually tied now for Objective-C. This information comes from RedMonk, which is a site that's been doing kind of a quarterly ranking of the most popular languages since 2011. And what's really cool is they say that Swift has become the fastest growing language that they've ever seen since they started the list. And as a matter of fact, I think it's been about 4 years since we've had Swift, if I'm getting my timing right, and it's already tied with Objective-C. And they kind of base this on looking at GitHub and I think Stack Overflow kind of information, and they aggregate it. So, you know, it's not definitive, but it's a pretty good list, and they're one of the few places that is kind of doing it. So Objective-C, or Swift rather, becoming very popular. And we've seen a lot of development happening in the Swift arena. It's kind of an interesting area to watch if you're into programming. So good on Apple for creating a very well-designed and in-demand programming language. If you're in California, they are the next state now to introduce a right to repair bill. And if you haven't heard about what this is all about, the idea is there's a number of states that are looking to add laws that would require smartphone manufacturers, actually not even just smartphone manufacturers, but appliance makers, electronics makers, those sorts of people, to provide repair information, replacement parts, and diagnostic tools for their products to owners and independent repair shops, so that you're not forced to go back to a manufacturer to get your device or your product repaired. And in fact, in addition to California, 17 other states have already introduced right to repair legislation. Those states include Washington, Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, Nebraska, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Virginia. And I imagine we're going to hear more of these bills kind of hitting different legislatures. And also, I don't know how this works globally. I'd be curious, because I know consumer protection laws, a lot of times outside the United States, seem to be a little bit more robust. But the idea behind this whole thing is that you have options for getting your devices repaired, and also that you'll be able to get your devices repaired maybe longer than the manufacturers are willing to repair them. So there's a lot of people that feel that these days, especially with electronics and especially with things like iPhones and some of the products that Apple makes, that there is this planned obsolescence. And the idea behind it is that they are trying to force upgrades, you know, that you buy new products rather than repairing and continuing to use your existing products. And so I think the idea behind these right to repair bills is great. You know, they allow consumers more freedom and choice when it comes to getting repairs on their aging equipment. Also, a big potential benefit is it would bring competition into the repair space, so your repair costs may actually go down if you have more options of places to take things to. Also, I think a really good thing about this is that manufacturers would have to make available good original quality parts for shops and DIYers, meaning that you're going to get good repair parts. You know, right now it's a little bit of a crapshoot when you go to get something from some supplier out of China. You don't know if you're getting a really safe or good product. Specifically, things like, you know, lithium ion batteries can be a little bit scary. If you get one that isn't well made, we all know what can happen. So I think it's good that, you know, there would be parts available that are good quality parts. And also, I think keeping older devices in the market longer means that they're staying out of landfills. You know, there's an environmental impact there. And this is all really, really good stuff. And so you would think that overall it's, you know, just a positive thing. But Apple is already reportedly lobbying against a lot of these right to repair bills in some states. And part of the concern from their perspective is they say that requiring them to do this would mean that they also have to remove certain software protections in place, specifically with things like the Secure Enclave and Touch ID. When you get in there to do repairs, there's certain things that you have to do. And they worry that this information being out there or having to disable some of these features is going to compromise some of the security protections that they've had to put, that they've put in place for their products, and that it could be information that could ultimately be used by hackers and ne'er-do-wells to kind of get into people's iPhones. So there's that concern that it would compromise the security of Apple's products. Another concern from manufacturers, not just Apple, is that repairs might not be done specifically to the specifications or standards of the original manufacturer, and that could potentially compromise the safety of the product for consumers. Again, if these repairs aren't done correctly or properly or tested properly, this could be an issue. But, you know, the point is if the manufacturers are supposed to make the repair information and diagnostic tools available, I don't see how that could necessarily be a problem. You can have certified and certification programs and, you know, high quality repair shops. And Apple already actually has those in a lot of ways with their Apple authorized service provider program, right? So there are places that aren't Apple retail stores you can take your stuff to, although they work directly with Apple. And what I know from a lot of those people is that there's currently kind of a lot of red tape and getting parts and things like that. In a lot of cases, they're having to send stuff back to Apple to actually have Apple do the repairs. They're not allowed to do the repairs themselves. And then again, you wouldn't get the benefits of sort of that cheaper pricing or that competitive pricing and things like that. So I think, you know, another issue that I have with sort of mandated or forcing manufacturers to go into something like this is that now they are forced to supply replacement parts for aging equipment, and that could come at a significant cost. And also just the management and overhead of that is, again, additional work that they're not having to do right now. And that ultimately is going to affect the cost of the parts. And for things too, like diagnostic tools and stuff like that, they're going to have to manufacture those things and make those available outside of their own ecosystem to third-party manufacturers. And so it's not kind of a silver bullet, I guess is what I'm getting at. I'm also not sure that the bill discusses or addresses, you know, controlling pricing of parts or equipment needed for those repairs. So could it just be a situation where the right to repair bill goes through and then the manufacturers just make replacement parts and the equipment so cost prohibitive to these companies that want to get into third-party repairs that we have another problem? Then we have to go in and regulate any kind of price fixing or component parts and stuff like that. It just gets really, really messy pretty fast. Overall, again, I think this is a great concept. It is a great idea. I think it is ultimately good for consumers. I would like to see it actually happen, but I think there's still a lot of questions that really need to be answered. You know, what about mandates about how a product must be designed? You know, could this get extended to say, well, Apple, you make your it's great that you now have parts available and diagnostic tools available and third parties can service these things, but you're doing stuff on the engineering side when you're designing your products that they're not easily serviceable enough. So now we need new laws to say, well, you have to design your products so that they're easy to open and people can get into them. You know, Apple currently uses a lot of glues and adhesives and things like that in their products. And I'm not sure that states should be able to mandate necessarily how any manufacturer chooses to design and build their products, right? There's a lot that goes into that engineering, and there's a lot of reasons why Apple does certain things the way they do. And, you know, maybe up for debate. Some people think it's to prevent repairs and things like that. But I think in a lot of cases, it's just what works best for the cost effectiveness of making the product and actually getting the product into the market. There's a lot of moving parts and things that go on here. So again, not so simple. On the surface, it seems like a great idea. That's something very easy to implement. Hey, you got to allow third-party makers and end consumers the ability to be able to repair their products, and you've got to provide the right parts and tools and information for them. It's a wonderful idea, but you know, I just don't know that in practice it really works out that well, and I think it just really complicates things. So I'm on the side that I think ultimately where I'm landing on this, you can tell I'm a little bit conflicted. I think where I'm landing on this is I would like to see this bill and these bills pass, but I do have concerns about what that means for Apple and the other manufacturers in the long run, and I don't know that it's ultimately going to completely solve the problem that we have today. I certainly don't think, I know I'm not on the side of the fact that Apple is purely doing this to force upgrades. I don't think that's what's going on here. And there are, you know, some people also argue there are third-party ways to get your stuff repaired. You know, we do have great sites like iFixit. And actually, iFixit is a big supporter of the right to repair bills. I think that's no surprise. But we have sites like iFixit that do kind of reverse engineer and create basically repair manuals for us. Them not having to do this, though, and being able to get the information directly from the manufacturers, I think is a good idea. I don't know. I'd be curious to know your opinion, and we can certainly have a conversation about it. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, yep, we have another week, another story of Apple trying to acquire another new piece of original content for their growing television program. This time, it's a story that Netflix is actually very close to signing a deal for a new series involving former President Obama and the former First Lady Michelle Obama. The deal with Netflix reportedly, though, is not done yet. It's not signed, sealed, and delivered. So the rumors are that both Amazon and Apple have also been in talks to try and acquire this show. What is the show? It's not really clear at this point what the series is going to exactly be, but some of the concepts say that it could be the president moderating conversations on issues that came up during his presidency, or they also mention a segment that could be the first lady doing shows about nutrition and fitness among children, something that she was a big proponent of when she was in the White House with the president. So, yeah, it would be certainly another very high-profile, very popular person to get a show over on Apple. But at this point, it does seem like it's something that Netflix is going to pick up. But Apple trying to do it nonetheless and expand their original content programming. Once again, I'm left with all these rumors, though, at wondering, how is Apple going to be rolling this stuff out, and when are they going to be rolling it out, and when are we going to hear about it? My assumption at this point is that maybe Apple is gearing up for an announcement sometime in the fall when we get the announcement of new iPhones and maybe expansion of either the Apple Music service or the announcement of some sort of new video service, but we aren't hearing any rumors about the rollout of this thing. All we get every week is the rumors of new programs. And of course, this week was no exception. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor. This week, it's Casper. You know, Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. I can tell you, we've had our Casper mattress for a few years now, and I honestly believe it's one of the best mattresses I've ever owned. In fact, my wife says she'll never buy another brand. She loves it so much. It's really just one of the most comfortable mattresses I've ever slept on. And one of the reasons why it's so comfortable is that the folks at Casper, they work tirelessly to create a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places. They combine multiple supportive foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amount of bounce and sink. And I can attest to that balance because I have to tell you, it's completely soft and comfortable, but for me, just firm enough that it offers great support. And I have kind of some back issues and things like that. So when I'm on a mattress that doesn't have that support, I certainly notice it. And Casper offers a wide array of other products, things like pillows and sheets to ensure an overall better sleep experience. And all Casper mattresses are designed, developed, and assembled in the US. And Casper is also able to offer affordable prices on their mattresses because they cut out the middleman and they sell directly to you. It's a really great way to purchase a mattress. And in case you're worried, you don't need to be because they will offer you hassle-free returns if you're not completely satisfied. Best of all, as a MacCast listener, you're going to get $50 toward a select mattress by visiting casper.com/MacCast and using the code MacCast at checkout. Terms and conditions do apply, but head to casper.com/MacCast and use the code MacCast at checkout to save $50 toward select mattresses. And a huge thank you to Casper for their support of the MacCast. Last week, I was talking to you about iPad Pros and possibly using them as replacements for laptops. There was a question from a listener. He wanted to know, do we think that eventually iPads and things like that are going to replace laptops? And I weighed in on my thoughts on that. I basically said, you know, I think we're going to have multiple kinds of computing devices for different applications. And I asked for some of your feedback and I got a bunch of it. Rick wrote in to say that he now does about 95% of his computing on the iPad Pro and has been doing that for the last couple of years. I thought that was amazing. I'm not quite there yet, Rick. I'm getting close. I would say I'm more in the 50-50 range, maybe 40-60, leaning a little bit more heavily toward my notebook, but I'm certainly doing some sort of mix. And actually, if I'm really honest about it, and I might have mentioned this in the last show, if I throw my iPhone in there, it's probably like a 20-40, you know, 50 kind of scenario. I don't really know, but I'm amazed that you're that far into the iPad Pro, but I don't think you're at all alone. Rick mentions that he does still have a MacBook Pro, but only turns it on occasionally to run backups and maybe dabble a little bit in Xcode. That was one of the areas that I mentioned for me, you know, programming wise, where the iPad Pro just isn't quite there yet. But Rick was also very excited about the future of different devices and different interfaces taking over, the expansion of things like voice interface with Siri and augmented reality. It certainly is a changing environment how we do our computing. And the general agreement was with that. But I'm still curious to hear from even more of you. What do you think about this thing, the future of sort of computing and the kinds of devices? Maybe expand the conversation a little bit more. You know, do you think that we're going to be moving more and more away? So rather than saying, hey, is the iPad going to replace the notebook in the future? I have the bigger question that I'm pondering now is what kinds of devices are going to be replacing notebooks and traditional desktops like we have today. And once again, from my side of this conversation, I don't think any of these things are going away completely, but I do feel like we're migrating. We're kind of moving more of our computing interactions to other devices, to the cloud, and there's this whole kind of fragmentation going on. But it's interesting because you think of fragmentation and you think, oh, that's a bad thing, right? That we're dispersing all this information in our computing to all these different devices and it's just going to get confusing because we have stuff spread all over the place. But really, that's not the reality, especially with a company like Apple because of the software integrations, right? I think that's really the key to the future of computing and the ability to use new kinds of interfaces like voice interfaces and augmented reality, virtual reality interfaces, is that we're not going to be using those solely in a vacuum, that we're going to be combining those experiences with other experiences. And really what we're moving into is different ways of computing that are appropriate and make sense in certain scenarios. You know, there's certain times when voice makes absolute sense. When I'm sitting here in my office and I want to listen to something on the HomePod, voice is the perfect way for me to have that interaction with the computer and with the cloud. If I'm trying to sit down and program a website, it's probably going to be more of a laptop or a tablet experience, right? If I'm just doing a text message or want to reply quickly to a voicemail or an email or something like that, that might be something completely different. And that could be multiple things in that scenario. So it's a very interesting time that we're living in. I think we're going through a little bit of a renaissance when it comes to computing interfaces. And it's a very interesting thing to think about. And I want to thank everybody who's been emailing in. And if you have any thoughts on this, please send me an email and really send some audio comments. I'd love to play some of your thoughts on future episodes of the MacCast around this topic. So shoot me an email, audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that I brought up on the last episode of the MacCast was a little bit of my, I think frustration's too hard of a word, my experiences with Face ID and how that compares to Touch ID. And I just don't feel personally in my experience that Face ID is as good on a day-to-day basis as Touch ID. That's not to say that I hate it. I think it's horrible. I actually think it's very good in a lot of areas, but I wanted to get your thoughts on how you felt about it, because I was feeling like I was in a little bit of a vacuum. A lot of times when I bring this stuff up, many people just reply, oh, Face ID is so amazing. I love it so much better than Touch ID. And luckily, there were a few of you out there that were kind of in my camp. I was trying to get allies, I guess, not feel so alone. Diego said he agrees with me that Face ID isn't quite where Touch ID was, but he does point out that it really is probably the best option if you want to go with an edge-to-edge display. And I would say I almost agree with that, Diego, although if Apple could have pulled off that under-screen fingerprint technology, I think that would have been probably the ideal solution. But the reality is, what we heard in the buildup was that Apple was working very hard on that technology and that ultimately it was just very problematic. And there's others that are working on that technology as well. A couple of you have pointed out and sent me links to, there's a few smartphone manufacturers now that are doing under the glass fingerprint technology. But as near as I can tell from the research that I've done, it's certainly not as secure and not as good, not anywhere near as good as Touch ID was itself. And Face ID, from a security standpoint, is even, you know, better than Touch ID when you're just talking about the potential of someone, you know, falsely getting into your device. So it does feel like what Diego was saying, that Face ID really for edge-to-edge displays is probably the best technology that we have right now. Will that change in the future? Will the under-the-screen fingerprint technology supersede that at some point? I think it potentially could. There might even be some sort of combo that goes on. But Diego in his email also had some questions for me. He said, you know, if they are going to switch iPads, like we were talking about earlier in the show, over to using Face ID technology, if they get updated to that, am I going to upgrade my iPad Pro with the Touch ID sensor. And I have to tell you, Diego, when I hadn't really thought about this question until you asked it, but my answer almost immediately was no. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I'm kind of landing on probably not. I absolutely love my 12.9-inch first-generation iPad Pro. I didn't even upgrade when they brought out the 10.5-inch. I think I'd like that size a little bit better because the 12.9-inch can get a little bit unwieldy. But it's not too bad, and I use it in scenarios really where I don't want to take my laptop out mobile with me. I'll take my iPad Pro, depending upon, again, the tasks that I know I'm going to do when I'm out and about. But I absolutely love my iPad Pro. I use it for so many things, drawing, taking notes, answering and responding to emails, doing show prep. It just is almost the perfect device. It's lightweight, compact, easy to take with me. And I just feel like it would take a lot more than just an upgrade to an edge-to-edge display and, you know, probably a smaller size with the same screen real estate in a 12.9-inch to get me to upgrade. I would like that, but I don't know if that in and of itself is enough to get me to upgrade. And plus, a little bit of my frustrations with the current generation of Face ID means that I'd probably want to stick with the Touch ID sensor at least for a little while longer. So I think that's where I'm landing on it at this point. Again, who knows? Apple, you know, when they bring something out, it could have amazing new features that put me over the edge and I just have to have it. You know, I am an Apple fanboy at the end of the day. I think there's no making excuses for that. So we'll have to wait and see. The other question that Diego asked was, why are there not development tools or coding tools like Xcode for the iPad Pro yet? And on that side of things, I honestly don't know. The only thing that I could maybe speculate on is that it has something to do with the sandboxing that exists in the environment. Again, because it's not as open at that low-level operating system level, that may be a little bit of a challenge. I would assume all of the software, you know, in terms of processing power and stuff like that, like something like an iPad Pro that has enough horsepower to manage that sort of stuff. It does get a little bit heavy at times, especially if you're doing a lot of heavy compiling, depending upon what you're building. So maybe there's some challenges there as well. I really don't know. I'd love to know if someone out there has some additional thoughts. I just don't do a lot of research and studying in that low level of kind of processing and coding and stuff like that. I work with programming languages, but I don't really kind of get down to the metal, as they might say. So I don't really know on that front, Diego. I imagine it's happening at some point that we will see some version, maybe an Xcode Lite for iPads at some point, and maybe you can start building some applications. I'd love to see more web development tools make their way to the iPad Pro. There's some great ones out there now, but like I said, because you can't do some of the low-level server sorts of things, it makes it a little bit of a limited platform, at least for me, in terms of programming. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. Getting back to some of the Touch ID versus Face ID debate, Chuck also wrote in to agree with me that in many scenarios, Face ID just isn't as seamless as maybe Craig Federighi wanted us to believe during his demo when he showed it off when announcing the iPhone X. And, you know, the reality is for things like when the iPhone isn't directly in front of your face, if it's down on a flat surface or off to the side, you do have to interact with the device. You have to pick it up. You have to move it directly in front of your face. And that essentially means that you are forced to think about the unlock process. It's not this seamless, like with Touch ID, you barely had to think about it. You could put your finger on the sensor as you were lifting the phone out of your pocket. And I get that with Face ID, you bring it up to your face, swipe up, and you unlock. That is definitely a seamless experience when it works. Doesn't work 100% of the time for me. I know it works better for other people, but still, in the scenario where you've got it off the side, or for example, I'm in the car and you get that inevitable message from Siri when you ask her to do something, she says, "I'm sorry, you need to unlock your iPhone to do that." You have to move your phone. You have to pick up your phone, which is not a great thing. You know, I don't want to be interacting with my phone when I'm in the car, and I actually don't do it. What happens is I just don't get to have those experiences anymore. And it was nice with Face ID to be able to, or Touch ID rather, to be able to just reach over without taking your eyes off the road or doing anything dangerous and simply set your thumb on that sensor. So it's those kinds of scenarios that I'm sort of talking about. But on the other hand, I did have many of you write in, and Peter was one of those folks, to say, hey, it works for me flawlessly, 99% of the time, without fail. I absolutely love it. There's also all those people, you know, I live in California, I'll admit it, nice weather here. Those people who live in cold weather environments where you're dealing with gloves, Face ID is a much better technology. But Peter does point out one area that I completely agree where Face ID is better than Touch ID. And that is with apps where they take advantage of Face ID for things like stored passwords and things that might be in your keychain. So being able to log into websites with Face ID or be able to use various apps that support Face ID, that is a magical experience. It's truly seamless. So I'm thinking of things like 1Password. I open up the 1Password app, it sees my face, boom, I'm right into 1Password. I don't have to do the Touch ID sensor thing or my banking apps or things like that. So that is a really great improved experience with Face ID. So I don't want to, again, I don't want to sound like I'm down on Face ID. I just think it's a first generation technology like Touch ID was back in the day. You know, at one point Touch ID was first generation and it wasn't perfect and it wasn't great and it needed some improvements. I just think there's some areas and some scenarios and some experiences with Face ID that can certainly be improved. And I fully expect Apple to address a lot of them in future versions with better sensors and, you know, better technology. All of this stuff always gets better. So I'm very positive about the future of Face ID. And I'm not, you know, if everything moves to Face ID, I'm totally happy with that. I think that's great. And I think it will only make those improvements come quicker. So it's a great thing. But again, if you want to chime in on this conversation with the rest of the community, shoot us an email, send us an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Now I have a tip for you, something I hadn't thought about in a while, because I'm not really into ringtones on my device, but I know a lot of people really do like them. And Ron wrote in, I'm assuming Ron's a Corvette fan, because he was trying to get a Corvette ringtone, something from the Corvette website, onto his iPhone. And they had some instructions on there on the Chevy website that were a little bit confusing. But basically, you were going to download an MP3 file and then using iTunes 12.7, get that on to your device. The problem is that Apple made some changes with how ringtones work when they did that last release. You know, the one where they removed app management and made things a little bit more difficult on us. Yeah, they also made managing ringtones a little bit more tricky. You can do it on your device and you can go in and manage your ringtones and you can go to the ringtone store from the ringtones area of the settings. But if you're trying to get a brand new ringtone, something that you want to create yourself onto there, it is a little bit tricky. And so the very first thing that you need to do is you need to get the file or the track that you want to use, whether it's an MP3, whatever audio format it is in, you need to get that into iTunes. So download your MP3, Ron, throw that into iTunes. And just note that with this trick, you cannot use anything that has DRM. So like Apple Music tracks, you're not going to be able to convert into ringtones, or stuff that you've just tried to stream off the cloud or anything like that. That's not going to work. You need to get an actual audio file without DRM into iTunes. And then you need to make sure that the length of that track is not longer than 30 seconds if you're planning to use it for a text tone, or if it's a ringtone, I think you can extend it up to about 40 seconds, maybe a little bit longer, but somewhere around the 30-second range is what you're going to want to get that audio file into. So if you are using a like full music track and you want to use just a segment of that, a 30-second clip, a little trick that you can do in iTunes before you do these next steps is go in, select that audio track in iTunes, choose Get Info, and then go to the Options tab. And you'll notice in there, there's a start and stop time. So you can set the start and stop times so that you have about a 30-second segment of that clip. So, you know, start at a certain time and then 30 seconds later, stop it. And then what'll happen is when you do this next step, which is going to involve converting that audio file, it will convert out just that little 30-second clip. And just remember to go back to the original track, get selected, get info, and turn off that start and stop time. Otherwise, in the future, when you're listening to your music in iTunes, you're only going to get that 30-second clip for that track. But once you've got it set up, once you've got your track ready to go in iTunes, what you're going to want to do is select the track that you want to use and then go into iTunes preferences, into the general tab, and check your import settings. Make sure that that is set to the AAC encoder and at the high quality 128K conversion rate. And then what you're going to do is you're going to select the track that you want to make into a ringtone in iTunes. And you're going to go under the file menu, you're going to choose convert, and you're going to convert it to, you're going to say create AAC version. So you need to have a 30-second, high-quality, 128K AAC version of your track. So let that convert, and then once that's converted in iTunes, click on that track, and choose right-click or control-click and choose the show in Finder, because you're going to have to now grab that track, and you are going to have to change the file extension on it from .m4a to .m4r. And this is really important because otherwise iTunes is not going to, or really more accurately, iOS in your iPhone is not going to recognize that file as a ringtone unless the file extension on the file name is .m4r. So change that file extension, and then you may even want to drag it out onto the desktop or someplace more convenient for you to be able to find it for this next step. You could leave it in your iTunes folder. It's totally up to you. But now what you're going to do is you're going to connect your device, your iPhone, to your Mac using the Lightning cable. And then again, back inside iTunes, you're going to want to select the device. So click on the little device icon in iTunes. And then in the sidebar under On My Devices, the On My Devices section, you want to make sure you click on the Tones section. And this is going to be directly on your device. So the change that kind of happened with this latest version of iTunes is you need to load your audio files, your ringtones, directly onto the device. You're just going to drag and copy them directly onto the device. And the way you do that is through the little Tones section. So you might be able to guess the next step. You're going to take your ringtone, your .m4r file, you're going to drag it from the Finder, and you're going to drop it right into the Tones panel inside iTunes, so that main big area. And once you drop it, what it'll do is copy that audio file, that ringtone, onto your device, and then you'll have that ringtone available to select. So now you should be able to go into your iPhone, into the settings, under Sound and Haptics if you're running iOS 11, and go into the ringtone section, and you should see your new ringtone up there ready to use. And if you don't see it, you might have to reconnect your device to iTunes with the Lightning cable and manually click the sync button in the device area. So, you know, again, select your device, go in there, and just make sure that you've synced your device over. But when you initially drug it into iTunes, it should have automatically copied over to your device, and then you should be good to go. So, Ron, I hope that explains how to load an iTunes, a ringtone onto your device using iTunes 12.7 and up. I guess we're not really and up yet, but you get the point. If you're using the latest version of iTunes, that's how you get a ringtone onto your device. I know, kind of a complicated process, which is probably why I don't do too many custom ringtones. But I know a lot of people are very into them, so hopefully if you've been struggling with this, that will help you out. All right, finally for you today, I have a pretty cool thing of the moment. This thing came up because I had to do a presentation for my Mac user group. They wanted me to come talk about HomePod and Siri and HomeKit, and I realized I didn't really have, you know, I have in-wall switches in my house from Insteon for controlling my lighting, and so I didn't really have kind of a standalone device that I could take with me to demo. So I was looking around. I wanted to find something that was simple and easy to use that I could bring to the user group meeting and play around with and show people how HomeKit worked and how Siri worked and how it all worked with the with the HomePod, and I found a really cool product in these LifeX bulbs. And what I liked about the LifeX bulbs were that they had no hub required. So a lot of lighting systems like the Philips Hue system, you have to buy this little hub and then you buy the additional lights. And the hub is kind of the thing that talks to the lights and controls everything. These LifeX bulbs actually have the hub built right into the device. The other thing that I liked about these was the fact that it didn't support just HomeKit, because I do have an Amazon Echo. But it wasn't just a HomeKit product. And a lot of HomeKit products, what you'll find is a manufacturer will have one for HomeKit, one version for HomeKit, and then one version for kind of everything else. So if you want to use Google Assistant with like a Google Home or an Amazon Alexa, you've got to buy a completely separate set of bulbs, and the streams don't cross. They don't converge. Well, this product actually supports everything. It has Apple HomeKit, Google Assistant, Amazon Alexa, even works with Nest. And so I thought that was pretty cool. I'm like, okay, great. No matter what I want to test and play around with, this bulb is going to let me do that. And I also wanted something that was going to be easy to set up. And I have to say, you know what? It impresses me every single time I use it, but Apple has done a great job making HomeKit completely easy to set up. I went out, I purchased this LifeX bulb. It's a multicolor. I also wanted one that was able to do multicolors and different color temperatures of the white light, so I could have warm white or soft warm light or cool light, depending upon what I want. And so it had all these features in it. But what I love about the HomeKit setup was how easy it was. All I had to do was open up the Home app. There's a little code that was on the back of the little instruction sheet that came with the bulb, the HomeKit code. Open up the Home app, I click Add Device, and then I point my iPhone camera at the HomeKit code, and literally in a matter of a minute or so, the bulb was on my network, it was set up, it was ready to go inside the Home app, and inside the Home app, I could control all of the features of the bulb. I was able to turn the light on and off, see the state of the bulb, whether it was on or off. I could go through the colors. They had some preset colors in there, and I could also go in and edit and add custom colors. So all the colors of the rainbow, and even play around with the color temperatures. And they had some presets for that. So I could do my cool white or my warm white. It was doing all that stuff, and I could do it either from the Home app or with Siri voice controls on my iPhone, my iPad, my HomePod worked immediately, really super quick and easy. And it is just really an amazing thing. And what really drove that home for me was I mentioned I have an Amazon Echo, and I wanted to be able to, you know, play around and test how it worked there as well. And that process was not so seamless. I even got lost. I had to send a support article. I had to like request support from the company, because what it involved was downloading the app. Oh, and I should mention there is a LifeX app for iOS, but at least from what I can tell, you probably won't need it with HomeKit. You can download it, but I didn't notice anything in the app itself that it offered in terms of controls for HomeKit over and above what you got inside the Home app. Now, if you want to connect with other services like Google Home or Alexa, you do need to download the app. So I downloaded the app, and then I had to add the bulb to the app, which that wasn't too bad. You know, I was able to add it pretty quickly and easily from my home network. And then I wanted to get it set up with Alexa. So I opened up the Alexa app, which was kind of the next step, and tried the process of adding that to the Smart Home app inside, or the Smart Home section, I guess, inside the Amazon Alexa app. And it went and it said it was scanning, looking for the bulb, and it didn't find it. I tried it over and over again. I tried resetting, turning the bulb on and off. I tried, you know, all of these things. Couldn't get it to work, and that's when I sent the email to support. Well, the next day, I was prepping for my talk. I was looking through the app, and what I realized was that the app had a second step. So I didn't just need to add the bulb to the app. Once the bulb was in the app, I also had to add the bulb to the LifeX cloud service, which would put the bulb up in the LifeX cloud, and then the LifeX cloud could talk to the, I guess, Amazon Alexa cloud and see the bulb, and then that would route back through to the Alexa app and to my Alexa devices in my house, and then I could get everything connected. And once I did that, it worked flawlessly. It worked great. So it does work great with Amazon Alexa. It's just the setup process was just a little bit more complicated. So not a huge deal, but it did drive home and sort of illustrate the advantages, some of the advantages of HomeKit. You know, Apple able to integrate the hardware and software so seamlessly makes that experience go a lot easier for many of us, myself included. But anyway, let's get back to the LifeX bulbs. They are great. They offer a range of products, including bulbs in various shapes and sizes. So they have, you know, the big down lights and your standard bulbs. They have mini bulbs. They have light strips. They have these things called beams, which look like these kind of plastic bars that have multicolored lights in them. And they even have those cool little light panels that, you know, some people are using. And you can get them in a number of places. I purchased mine at Best Buy, but they also sell them in the Apple Store. I think you can get them on Apple Online. Specifically, in case you're wondering, the model I got was the LifeX A19 bulb, basically your standard household light bulb. And they do have different sockets. So they have US sockets and UK sockets, and they have different kinds of versions of each bulb in terms of how you connect them in. So do a little bit of research, make sure you're getting the right one for your country and for your bulb socket. But they worked really great. And again, what I really liked about the product, what really sold it for me, was not having to have another hub to connect to my router. That was a big bonus for me. But the downside of that, and the downside of actually having a multi-platform device that's hubless, is it does add significantly to the cost. So if you follow these things, if you have been looking into smart bulbs and stuff like that, you know there's a whole range. I think you can get in some platforms bulbs down to about the $20 price range per bulb, which is pretty inexpensive. The LifeX bulbs, you're going to pay a little bit of a premium for. Again, I picked mine up at Best Buy. It was $55 US. I noticed on the website as I was prepping the show, it looks like they might be down to about $50 per bulb, but they do say that they should last about 23 years. So I assume, you know, the technology behind HomeKit may die out before my actual bulb needs replacing. So it should last a really, really long time, a lot longer than your traditional bulb. And they do offer multi-packs, like 4 and 6 packs, at a slight discount, but it's certainly not the cheapest way to go if you're trying to get some smart bulbs. But I can tell you from my experience, it's one of the most convenient ways to go, especially if you're integrating with HomeKit devices. So I was just infinitely impressed by the product. I thought it was great. I'll probably pick up a few more, not a ton of them because of the price, but they are really great. So that makes it this week my thing of the moment, the LifeX bulb, lifex.com. That's lifex.com. And of course, I'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes at madcast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out more information and see all of Smile's great products at smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.